GeoTrek podcast number 89 took us to the Gulf of Mexico conference in Tampa, Florida, where we heard perspectives about the importance of making our coastal communities more resilient to extreme weather and coastal hazards. At the conference, I met my favorite meteorologist, Carl Parker, from the Weather Channel. Not only did I get to visit with Carl for around 15 minutes, but he agreed to be a guest on the GeoTrek podcast. Carl is my favorite meteorologist because he's such a great teacher. His love of science and passion for excellent science communication comes through very clearly on this episode of the GeoTrek podcast. Hey, GeoTrekkers, this is Dr. Hal, host of the GeoTrek podcast. GeoTrek explores the world to tell stories about extreme weather and natural disasters not covered by the mainstream media. We take a deep dive into the physical processes that create such events, their impacts on society, and what we can do to get out ahead of such events to reduce the loss of life and property. Hey, you can do us a big favor by subscribing to this podcast on your favorite podcast platform. Your subscription helps us mark progress, making it easier to form professional partnerships moving forward and ensuring many more episodes of the GeoTrek podcast in the future. Well, without further introduction, let's jump into GeoTrek podcast number 91, a chat with my favorite meteorologist, Carl Parker from the Weather Channel. Carl, thank you so much for taking time to come on the GeoTrek podcast.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Carl, many meteorologists develop this passion for weather when they're really young. A lot of them have this formative extreme weather event when they're like 4 or 5 years old. Tell us, for you, when did you get interested in the weather? And was there some big event in your childhood that you think back to that influenced your fascination with meteorology?
You know, I can't remember one single event, but I do remember a lot of different events occurring. You know, I grew up in the DC area, and that whole thing about, you know, 40 or 50 years ago, kids did whatever they want. That's actually kind of true. You know, in addition to riding my bike outside all day long, I would stand outside during thunderstorms, which of course is completely preposterous. But that's the kind of thing I did. I was really into thunderstorms and other events at a very early age, I remember. The blizzard of 78 stands out. We got a couple of feet of snow, but it felt like more like three where we were in Northern Virginia. I remember some tropical systems coming through. I remember the remnants of Hurricane David and how different that felt. And that, you know, probably was one of the events that really stuck with me. I really got a bug for tropical weather. And, you know, even to this day, I just find it to be fascinating. I'll never forget the first time that I saw hurricane force wind. I think I might have mentioned this to you at the conference we were at. It was Hurricane George in 1998, and we were driving into the eyewall. And you can't really get a good sense of how strong the wind is when you're driving.
Sure.
But we got out of the car in Mobile, and you know, I'll never forget this. We got out on a north-south street, and the wind was coming out of the east. And you know, I'm pretty sure there was some Bernoulli going on. It was being funneled. Yeah. But the lights were still on. The street lights were still on. So what I saw at the intersection was this very linear feature. It just looked like a line coming across the street, and it had this hiss. It was just going,
yeah.
And I remember looking at that and thinking, wow, that is really different. That is, you know, as compared to thunderstorms where it goes and goes and goes for a little while, and then it kind of lets up. This was not doing that. This was just this consistent laser beam, this stream. And I was just completely blown away by that. Also went into Hurricane Brett in 1999. You know, that was also an incredible experience. So yeah, I think that's probably my favorite kind of weather. You know, it's just, there's so much power, and it's sort of the ultimate, getting into a core because once you're in it, you know, I mean, you're in for the long haul. So I really love tropical weather.
Yeah, that first time, I remember for me, that first time getting in a tropical storm or hurricane, it was way more intense than I expected. My first was Hurricane Erin in 95 in eastern Florida. And I think sustained winds were in the mid 40s, but I was getting sandblasted. And I was like, okay, this is what I pictured hurricane force winds to be. And the winds are like sustained 46. So it was like, okay, this is, the scale of it is just way beyond what I expected.
Yeah, that's a funny thing, because I remember I had a handheld when I was in Brett. I was in Falfurrias, this little town in deep South Texas. And I had my handheld and I'm out there getting readings. And I'm like, man, this must be hurricane force wind. And I'm getting 58 and 59.
Yeah, that's it.
And then I finally got a 79 as I was kind of reaching around the corner of the building. And it left welts on my wrist. The rain actually left welts on my, and that's just hurricane force, which is incredible when you think about that. I mean, you're talking about just getting to hurricane at that level. They actually got a gust of 98 in Falfurrias. So I remember that night. It was amazing. We had a forecaster at the Weather Channel, and his name is Matt Crowther, and one of the best forecasters I've ever known. And I was on the phone with him. This is before smartphones. And he said, well, I think you're probably going to get the eyewall at about 2:30 in the morning.
Okay.
And 2:20, it just took off. I mean, it went bananas.
Yeah.
And I was just taking my breath away. And, you know, I could just start to begin to wrap my mind around those comparisons about, you know, how many bombs it's equivalent to.
Yeah.
It's
yeah.
so much power. You cannot believe the amount of power and how long it goes on.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think it's really good that I went through things like that, because I do think that it helps me to relate to people who are going sure. through that. You know, you want to understand that, you know, it really is kind of a sustained assault
it
on
is.
People. Yeah. And, you know, I think it was good for me to have had that experience.
Well, and I see people that have had field work in them, they stop saying things like, it's only a Cat 1, right? Because once you've tried to stand up in 85-mile-an-hour winds, you're like, you'll never say that again, because you realize even a Cat 1 is incredibly destructive, right?
That's one of my big complaints, you know, about, you know, what we hear sometimes in media is, well, you know, it's only a Cat 1 or it's only a TS. Those words should never come out of anyone's mouth. Because every storm is different, and you know, storms that are remnant lows can cause incredible destruction in terms of heavy rainfall and flooding. So yeah, I mean, you know, only it's just not something that we should say in this profession.
Yeah, I 100% agree. And I think for those of us that have gotten out in some of these events, it really changes maybe how we even forecast or communicate even from a studio. Carl, I wanted to ask you, I mean, I'm really curious to hear about your path into professional meteorology. Like, okay, so you had this interest as a kid growing up in Northern Virginia in the DC area. What was the path then to get into professional work?
Well, so, you know, it's really interesting because I took a tour of a TV station when I was in the fourth grade. In DC, it was Channel 9, then known as WDVM. It's now WUSA. And so I was 10 years old, and that was the day. That was the day I decided this is what I want to do. And you know, I've since come to understand that that's kind of a rare thing to be that single-minded about it. I went to the University of Maryland, which has a very good meteorology school, but I ended up going to Mississippi State because at the time it was the only program in the country that was specifically geared towards broadcast. I didn't realize it was going to become kind of a thing later on in later years. And when I was there, I actually started working in Tupelo on the weekends at WTVA. And I was, you know, I was so green. I was 22 years old and, you know, I really didn't know what I was doing. I really probably shouldn't have started doing it while I was still in school. But that's what ended up happening. And I had some pretty funny experiences there. You know, we had a direct line to a weather service radar, WSR 74, so named for the year in which it was developed. And, you know, not a great radar. And I remember one time I got up there and I said, oh, looks like we're, you know, in good shape tonight, and did the broadcast and started on my hour plus journey back to Starkville. And it was like Armageddon on the way back home. And, you know, it was one of those early, you know, you learn a lot of humility in this profession. And that was one of my first lessons in humility. And you know, I had a lot of funny experiences at that station. We also had a director who would do the evening shows, the 6 and 10 o'clock shows. And he liked to go out and have a smoke in between the shows. And I don't mean cigarettes. And most of the time he was fine unless he got lost. And one time I was up there and I saw everything he could possibly put up behind me. There was a child playing piano and farm equipment, every source you can possibly imagine. And, you know, I don't know how I handled it, but I'm sure it wasn't, you know, all that great because, you know, again, I was so young. So it was, I think you kind of have to do that in television. You kind of have to work at these stations to get off the ground. And then I went to Harrisburg for 4 years, and the big notable event there was the Superstorm in 93, which was incredible. I was, again, very green out in that without the proper gear. We got stuck in the middle of that, and there were snowmobilers that were looking for idiots, and they found some, and they helped us dig out. We drove back the wrong way on the highway to get back to the station. You know, just a lot of stupid stuff that I did in early in my career. I was there for 4 years, and then I went to Houston for 4 years and got a real taste of tropical rain down there and tropical cyclones. And then I went to the Weather Channel in 1999. And so I've been there for 25 years.
Well, pretty cool, too, how you got to live and forecast and work in these different regions of the country, right? So you're covering a lot of regional weather there. You're getting to know the people, the culture, and obviously a big blizzard in Pennsylvania is very different than a tropical system in Southeast Texas. It seemed like you got to kind of live and experience and forecast in those different regions.
Yeah, no question about that. I mean, I think that was very helpful. And you do come to understand that people have different, you know, levels of knowledge, depending on, you know, what they experience the most. My particular interests tend to be, you know, tropical meteorology and severe local storms. And so I definitely enjoyed, you know, being more in southern regions than northern regions, even though I grew up, you know, in the Mid-Atlantic region.
Sure. Carl, I have to say, growing up, I was a Weather Channel addict. And I have to say, you were my favorite meteorologist. And I'll tell you why. You not only forecasted, but you, every opportunity, you would teach the science. You would teach the meteorologist and look for an opportunity, not just to give a forecast, but even if it was just teach a little nugget of wisdom. It was like, oh, okay, something new we learned today. This is really interesting. Like, in your value system or in your perspective, why was it so important to do your best to teach as well as just giving a forecast?
Well, you know, I think it's really the one thing that I learned is it's really important to figure out what interests you. And, you know, I really never felt content just kind of getting up there and saying, this is this, and this is that, and this is this. You know, what the reason why I love meteorology is because of the why, you know, the things that make the science tick, you know, that's what it's all about. And so I think it's important for yourself to find that passion, because that really helps to keep you going. I think it's important probably for the audience too. I mean, there have been times when I've been watching auto racing and I'm listening to a guy tell me about the intake manifold, and I don't really know what an intake manifold is, but he's interested in it and he's very passionate about explaining it. So I'm into it, you know, and that's what I try to do when it comes to explaining the science. And I really like trying to find ways to explain it that I think can be understandable. Like, one thing that I came up with several years ago was the idea of explaining instability by talking about taking a ball and trying to push it under the water in the pool. And I think most people have had that experience. And whenever you do that, it wants to jump out. And the reason why, of course, is because the air is much less dense, but the water is also less dense closer to the top of the pool. And so you have a similar thing with instability, in that your parcel is less dense and it wants to get to a point where the atmosphere is less dense, and that causes it to rise. And so it's things like that that I've had people say to me, hey, that really helped me to understand that, and that's really gratifying. But also I think it can help with you know, safety, because when people, or, you know, can be empowering, because when people understand things a little bit better, you know, maybe they're not so nervous about it. You know, if, for example, you're in an area where they're, you know, they've been talking about the severe weather potential for several days, but it happens to have rained really heavily all day, well, you know, you can understand, if you're paying a lot of attention to weather, that your instability is probably not there. You know, obviously there are cases where that can change, but in a lot of cases, that means you're probably going to be in good shape, even if you've got a really dynamic system coming in. So I hope that, you know, doing that, explaining things, helps people to feel a little more empowered.
Yeah, I like what you said about being empowered. You know, I actually live not far from Houston, where you were based for a few years. I'm on Galveston Island. And people picture South Texas as just being, you know, warm and tropical year round. But as you know, February, March, we get a lot of really dense sea fog. It's a setup very much like San Francisco, right? With relatively warm, moist air blowing over the cold coastal waters. But what I thought is interesting, people will hit me up all the time. Are we going to get fog on Saturday, right? Well, maybe there's an offshore wind. And if you know the process, you know, if a cold front passed, you have an offshore wind, there's a 0% chance. The physics are not there, right, to get sea fog. But I thought it's interesting, once people understand how it forms and they understand the process, a lot of times they're empowered to think like, oh, I know there won't be any fog this weekend because I kind of understand how it works.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I and that's why I think that, you know, communication and weather is not ever really going to go away. Much the way that, you know, you can look things up on WebMD, but you want to talk to somebody if there's something going on, you know, medically. And I think it's also true about meteorology and particularly with extreme weather. I think people want that sort of human connection to be able to, you know, hear what somebody has to say about, you know, how things are evolving.
No, that makes sense, right? Even if we want more than just an answer, right? We want to maybe feel connected or have some connection with the person and the science and maybe more confidence with what's being communicated, perhaps. Absolutely. Carl, I wanted to ask you, what are your favorite type of weather events to forecast?
So I really enjoy tropical meteorology and severe local storms. You know, forecasting can be a lot of fun. It can also be very frustrating. You know, it can go south very easily. As I've said, you know, before, yeah, it can be a really humbling profession. You're always, if you don't feel like you're always learning something, I think something's wrong, because there's always something to learn. And I really like nowcasting and radar meteorology. You know, even though so much of what is in meteorology can be quantified, there is an element of pattern recognition in the science. And that's particularly true when you're in a real-time situation, you know, when you're tracking storms and you're trying to see whether or not a velocity couplet is tightening up or what other signs you're seeing on the storm. You know, that kind of thing I think is really challenging and, you know, sometimes very important, you know, to let people know, because, you know, this is kind of the, you know, when a tornado warning is issued, obviously it's issued for a very good reason, but there are gradients within a tornado warning. You know, there are cases where there was a very clear signature and then it went away pretty quickly, but the warning is still up. There are cases where there is a signature and then it gets a lot worse as you go through the tornado warning. So, you know, these are areas where I really like to, you know, again, hopefully help people to understand what's going on a little better.
Well, I think with better streaming and real-time radar apps and different availability of that technology, I think we've been seeing a lot of people that have skill in that nowcasting and radar interpretation can really help a lot of people out in the moment, right?
I hope so. You know, it's and you know, it's funny because I've been doing this for so long. There are times when you can look at a return, you can look at velocity or something like that, and you can just know intuitively. You know, I remember last year when we were doing Mississippi and the Rolling Fork tornado occurred. And it was just one of those cases, you know, like similar to what happened in Tuscaloosa, where I'm just looking at it and I'm just going, you know, and it kind of, and when I'm on the air, you know, I end up kind of just, you know, sort of stopping down for a moment because I, you know, often just kind of run through everything and I say, this is this, and this is this, and this is what this looks like. But when I see something like that, you know, I kind of stop for a second internally, and I think, you know, externally as well, and say, look, folks, this is it. It is time now to get to the safe place. Now, you know, no fooling around with this. And I actually heard from one of our reporters that somebody heard me say that and got to their safe place, and they believe that they survived. And that's really gratifying. I don't, you know, hear that all that often. And, you know, I really am, you know, so honored and humbled that I was able to help somebody in that situation. And that's really what I, you know, endeavor to do whenever I can.
Carl, that type of radar nowcasting, it's so dynamic. It's just unfolding in real time. Is there a time, like, do you just feel like you get in a flow with it? Or is there a time where it feels like it's just moving too fast to like even process it or communicate it? Like how do you see what's going on, interpret that and communicate that so quickly in real time?
Well, you know, a lot of times it's a multi-effort. I mean, there are times when I'm basically working on my own and I'm, you know, changing my graphics and trying to keep up with everything. There are times when, you know, for example, if we have a real outbreak and we've got a dozen warnings simultaneously, well, we usually have other people, like we'll have a weather producer that's standing by, and they can be a second set of eyes, and they can say, hey, check out the storm that's up there, you know, so-and-so. And, you know, if I can't keep up with every single thing, because there are certainly cases where that's the case.
Yeah, no, that's true. If you're in a studio, or even the storm chasers will say sometimes there's multiple cells they're following, and having multiple people on a team can help process all that information in real time. Pretty cool. Carl, I wanted to ask you, you know, weather and Mother Nature has a way of surprising even the most seasoned forecasters. Is what weather event stands out to you for surprising both the meteorological community and the public? Does anything stand out to you?
Yeah, well, the one that really upset me for a while was Irma, because there were a number of things that happened there. You know, one was obviously that the modeling switched quite a bit from the beginning of that, you know, whole forecast period to the end of it. The other was that, you know, the modeling did settle in to some extent in the middle of that, taking the storm to Tampa. And we focused on Tampa a fair amount because, I mean, that, you know, we've said many, many times, that has the potential to be among the worst hurricane disasters in U.S. history, were you to get a high-end storm that came up, you know, from the southwest right up into Tampa Bay. I mean, the amount of property at risk there is truly staggering. So, you know, while the forecasts look like that, it made sense to be focused on that. But, you know, we also did make a point of saying, look, this is a very difficult forecast because the coastline is angled from north-northwest to south-southeast. And the angle of attack of this storm is south-southwest to north-northeast. So a little bit of a deviation in the path is going to make an enormous difference in terms of where it goes. And we did say that multiple times. And as always, we talked about the fact that impacts lie well outside of the cone. The one thing that drives all of us nuts is when people say, well, I was in the cone, so I did this, or I was not in the cone, so I did this. That's another thing that you know, we're trying really hard to, you know, get people to not do. To not think that way, because it's not an impacts cone. It's simply telling you the average forecast error out to a point and relative to the center. Impacts typically lie well outside of the cone, and the storm itself often lies outside of the cone. So we knew that there was this risk, and in fact, the Hurricane Center put out storm surge watches and storm surge warnings well to the south of where the cone actually was. And, you know, we pointed that out. So I'm really glad to see that the Hurricane Center is moving in the direction of de-emphasizing the cone, and they're going to, you know, talk more about actual impacts. I think that's really, really important, because I do think there's been a sort of outsized importance placed on the cone, and we're going to be moving in that direction as well.
Yeah, I think that's so important. At the end of the day, people want to know what's going to happen in my zip code. What's the wind risk? What's the flood risk, right? I mean, whether that was inside the cone or outside the cone, in a sense, as far as impacts, it often doesn't even really matter, right?
It really doesn't, you know, but you do still hear this all the time. You know, I can't tell you the number of interviews that I've seen where people said, well, we were in the cone, so we did this, or we weren't in the cone, so we didn't do anything. We were waiting to see if we got in the cone. And, you know, that's just something that we really hope to drum out of people.
Yeah, I've noticed, too, people tend to assume the closer you are to the eye, the higher your risk. And you and I know if you're 30 miles to the left of the eye wall, your damage is probably much less than 100 miles to the east of the eye wall, right? So it's this very lopsided system often, right, that the impacts are very lopsided. And I imagine that's a huge challenge to communicate.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that's certainly part of it as well, you know, and I think we do emphasize that, talking about the right front quadrant a lot more. You know, another thing that is making this really challenging is that you've got a changing baseline in sea level. And so, you know, and I know you've been aware of this, you know, we've seen even modest events causing significant water level rises along the East Coast, for example, in recent years. I mean, it's just taking less to cause, you know, really significant surge. And then the other thing is there's a time horizon bias. You know, when you haven't had a storm in a given area for a really long period of time, you tend to think, well, we're probably not going to get much. I mean, if you think about Southwest Florida, the last storm that they had that was really impactful was Charlie, which was, you know, sort of a, you know, large tornado. I mean, it really wasn't, you know, that surge is all about size. And yeah. Charlie definitely did not have that. The RMW was, you know, about a third of what it is normally. Sure. So, you know, it was just this, you know, incredible windstorm that came up through the middle of Florida, which, you know, by the way, I thought was really interesting, prompted the development of the extreme wind warning. That the Melbourne office was really innovative, and they just issued tornado warnings all along the path of the eyewall because they wanted to communicate that this is going to be tornado-like wind coming through. But that storm really didn't produce much in the way of surge. And so, you know, the people that live in Southwest Florida, and so many people have moved to Florida. Yeah. I mean, those coastal counties have grown by, you know, 200-400% in some cases over the last several decades. And, you know, there are so many people that don't have the same level of experience with storms that, you know, that other people do. And so they just don't think that they're going to be in for a 15-foot surge, even if the storm surge warning is up, even if, you know, those values are coming out of the hurricane center. It just doesn't seem real, I think. And I think with surge in particular, we're going to have to ask people to be more imaginative, to think about things that they haven't experienced before. And this is something that I've talked about a lot when in climate science, you look at the range of natural variability. You know, what are the sort of guidelines for events historically? And what climate change does is it causes events that lie outside of those bounds. And this is why we hear from people over and over and over again, I've never seen anything like this before. And that's where we're headed. And that's what we need people to be thinking about. You're going to see things that you haven't seen before, most likely. And so you probably have to be a little more reactive as a result, and, you know, maybe a little more proactive in terms of, you know, things you can do to shore up your homes.
Well, Carl, let's talk a little bit more about that, the impact of climate change, say specifically on tropical weather. I met you at the Gulf of Mexico conference, and you shared some really important insights about this interface between climate change and tropical weather. And you referenced in particular Hurricane Dorian, which unfortunately just shredded the Bahamas back in 2019. And that storm showcased several characteristics you said we can expect to see more of in the future. What were those characteristics and why is that so important?
Yeah, Dorian was the one that really sort of shocked us all. I remember, you know, being there with Dr. Nabb, and we were just looking at this thing and just thinking, wow, you know, I mean, this is kind of a culmination of so much of what we've talked about. You know, we know that the oceans are warming, that there is a greater depth to that warmth, which is important because as you churn up the water and you typically get upwelling and cooler water coming up from below, if there's a really significant depth to that 26C isotherm, then you're just bringing up more and more fuel, even as the storm is getting stronger. So maximum potential intensity is rising across the board in, you know, not just the North Atlantic, but all around the world. And it obviously takes a lot of different things to make a hurricane, but if you equal out those other factors, if you have more warmth, you're going to get more potential for an intense storm. So what has been observed is an increase in intensification rates and also a greater proportion of high-end hurricanes. And, you know, we've seen some really eye-popping storms in recent years, you know, storms that, you know, stay at high intensity for more than a day. You know, I don't know if you remember seeing the photo of Michael. I've got a photo that was, you know, taken by a storm chaser, and it's incredible. To look up in the sky and see the circle in the sky, a blue circle in the sky. You know, I know that that's been seen, particularly in the West Pacific and over islands. But for that to occur with a landfalling storm in the U.S., I don't know that I've ever seen anything like that because, you know, usually you have some cloud, a fair amount of cloud in the eye. So you get a brightening and you get a slackening of the winds. But to have that level of subsidence, you've got to have the very most intense hurricane to see that blue sky like that. And that's what we saw in the case of Michael, and that's what we saw in the case of Dorian as well. But another thing is that forward speed is decreasing. Now, that has not been confidently tied to warming, but there has been a trend that's been observed. You know, to me, it makes a lot of sense, you know, particularly in our, you know, neck of the woods, because if fronts are coming down later, then your upper level winds are not as strong, and upper level winds are what, you know, pull these things up. You know, I don't know if that's necessarily the connection, and I don't think that's been established, but it makes sense to me. So with Dorian, you had a convergence of all of those things. You had an extremely powerful storm, you know, it was tied for the strongest by wind speed at 185 miles per hour. It completely stopped. It just sat over the northern Bahamas for a full day. And it was 90 miles to the east of Palm Beach and Martin and St. Lucie counties. So if this thing had been 90 miles farther west, and that western eyewall at that intensity at 185 miles per hour had stopped over those counties for a day, which it very well could have had the upper level pattern been just slightly different, I think we could have been talking about, you know, the worst hurricane disaster in modern memory. And so, you know, that event in particular was the one that just, you know, I thought, wow, this is a sign of where we're going. This is where we're headed. And it's going to cause a lot of problems in the future. I mean, we're already sort of teetering in terms of insurance in Florida, you know, and you know, if we get one real big event, I think it's going to be really, really tough in Florida in particular.
Yeah. And like you said, Carl, I mean, that was a paper thin margin of error. You could almost really see some of the bands of this storm hitting eastern Florida. And like you said, the eyewall was, what, 90 miles east of a very highly populated area in Florida.
Yeah, it was so close. And, you know, of course, we've had a number of other storms that have been terrible and have, you know, actually made it in as terrible storms. You know, Laura certainly comes to mind. I mean, the amount of damage that we got in Lake Charles as a result of that is just, you know, I mean, there were blue roofs everywhere after that storm came through. So, you know, unfortunately, we're going to be in for a period of upheaval, you know, with tropical weather in particular. But, you know, I don't want to, you know, one thing is I do talk a lot about these, you know, climate issues, but I don't want it to sound like all bad news, because I do at the same time know that we're moving very, very quickly into new energy. So, you know, I think it's kind of a race at this point.
Well, and Carl, something I really liked when you were on stage at the Gulf of Mexico conference too, you mentioned we have to be aware of the patterns. We have to be aware of our risks. But I love that you also mentioned you can't get stuck in the gloom and doom and negative thought patterns. We also need to think about what we can do and messages of hope and things like that. I really like that, because I think otherwise it could really lead to paralysis, right?
There's no question about that. I mean, you know, if you tell people that something is terrible and there's really not much you can do about it, well, the human reaction to that, this is a universal thing, is to go, all right, well, I'm just going to kind of shove that down into a drawer because I can't do anything about it. It's really, really important for people to feel a sense of agency, to feel that they can do something or that something is being done. And when it comes to warming, you know, there is a lot of reason to be helpful right now. The example that I love to use is that the total amount of energy that the whole world needs every moment of every day is 18 terawatts. A terawatt is a trillion watts. We need 18 trillion watts. If we can come up with 18 trillion watts of clean energy, we will have fixed this problem. And turns out the sun gives us at the top of the atmosphere 173,000 terawatts. So, you know, there's more than enough energy available, clean energy available. And we're moving into that so rapidly because of cost. Several years ago, wind and solar got cheaper than fossil fuels, and that gap continues to grow. That's really, really important, because once it starts getting cheaper, once the dollar is in control, then it really matters a lot less what our policymakers are doing. And, you know, I mean, obviously things like the Inflation Reduction Act have been huge. But it's also something that, a case where the horse is out of the barn at this point. You know, we're off and running because it's cheaper. It just makes more sense. When it's cheaper to do something, you're going to see a gravitational pull in that direction. And so, you know, there have been some studies that have indicated that we could be looking at perhaps 12 terawatts of clean energy, maybe by the end of the decade, somewhere in that area. I mean, it's just astronomical the rise that's occurring right now because of the cost component. And if we do get to net zero, you know, maybe in another couple of decades, which, you know, I think is possible, there, you know, there's also a good reason to believe that warming will level off at that point and then begin to slowly decline. So, you know, this is the kind of thing that that gives people agency, knowing that there is something that can be done. Now, there will be feedbacks that will continue for long after that, but at least, you know, we can turn the ship at this point. And I think it's really important for people to realize that.
Yeah, for sure. And here, you know, the last 16 years, I've lived in Southeast Texas and South Louisiana, very much the heart of the U.S. energy sector. And it's been interesting for me to even see a shift in a lot of the energy producers talking more about clean energy and innovations and carbon capture. And you see it on billboards. You just hear it in the local culture. It's definitely been interesting to see the shift. And I think, like you said, as this is becoming more you know, available and cheaper and available on the private market, I think we're going to see more and more of it.
And, you know, and I really hope that we do see more of a shift. I mean, you know, the oil and gas industry has been, you know, among the most powerful and wealthiest industries in the history of the world. And they've got a lot of ability if you know, you just get away from quarterly thinking, you know, which is, you know, I think, a big part of our problem, and think more long term. They've got a lot of ability. They've got a lot of resource. You know, a lot of resources to allow them to pivot and to move, you know, into these different areas. You know, with utilities, I've said the same thing. You know, why not, if you're a large utility and you know that solar leasing is becoming a thing, or residential solar is becoming a thing, why not own that? Why not, you know, start doing leasing yourself, and you own the panels, they're yours, you put them on roofs. It reduces your capital costs in the long term because you've got all these people that are feeding energy back into the grid. Why not embrace that? You know, I always think about Napster, for example. You know, back when the music industry spent years and years and years trying to fight Napster, and that ended up taking over anyway. What if they had instead just purchased it? You know, what if they just embraced the model and just got right into it? I wonder how things would have been different.
Yeah, I think that's a really good example. And you're right. When innovation comes, I've heard people say that people already in the with the established industry a lot of times are fighting these things instead of embracing them, right? I heard this with even transportation. Like back in the day, the old railroad companies, they looked at themselves as railroad companies instead of people mover companies. So suddenly the airports became a huge threat instead of saying, hey, we're already established with a lot of capital. Maybe we should also invest in airports, right? A lot of times they were fighting the new innovation instead of maybe embracing it.
Yeah. And, you know, it's a very anti-free market position. The example that Bob Inglis used years ago, I thought was so good. You know, he was talking about the buggy whip makers. And, you know, historically, if you're on the right, you know, you'd be in favor of free markets and innovation. But by trying to protect oil and gas, what they've been doing is essentially protecting the interest of the buggy whip makers, even as this new horseless carriage is coming around, which is, it makes no sense. It's not the way that things are supposed to go. You're supposed to support innovation and just, you know, pivot as the situation demands. I've seen this with high-speed rail. Several years ago, they were planning to put in a high-speed rail line between Tampa and Orlando, which is kind of a no-brainer. That it's like, you know, 20 minutes between the theme parks and the beach. And the federal government was going to give Florida $3 billion to do this. And Florida rejected the money. And they said they didn't want it. And that was based on a study, which turns out was funded by all the people who don't want you getting a look at high-speed rail, which is such a great way to travel in a lot of ways. I mean, you think about how annoying, you know, traveling can be. Obviously, driving can be a huge hassle with traffic. And then, you know, flying is just getting worse all the time. And, you know, here you've got a form of transportation where you have these, you know, big seats and you can get up and you can move around. And, you know, a lot of other parts of the world have really mastered this. I mean, Europe and certainly parts of Asia. And we've been fighting it every step of the way because of the interests that don't want you doing that.
Yeah, and like you said, it's good for the environment. It's efficient, and you hop in that train and get dropped off by the beach. You don't have to worry about parking, right? It just makes a lot of sense. And like you said, there's a system trying to impede it, and I agree with you. I would sure love to see some of that overturned in the near future. Carl, fascinating conversation here with you. Before we finish, I wanted to ask you this because I'm really curious on your perspective on this. We often have high school and college students that listen to the show, or people that are interested to get into meteorology or get into science communication. What advice would you give for your students and young professionals coming up who want to be broadcast meteorologists or want to be science communicators? What advice would you give for them?
Well, you know, I would say the number one thing is to make sure that you love the science. I mean, it's an ever-changing science, and you really need to keep up with it. It's not good enough. You know, the one thing that has kind of bothered me about, you know, some of the debates within the community about, you know, what you did in school and so forth, is the idea that you learn everything you need to learn in 4 years. I think that's preposterous. I think I've learned way more in, you know, 33 years on the job than I did in the 4 years that I was in school. And so I think it's really, really important to love the science, because you want to be pursuing it because you're interested in it. And I have met some people who, you know, I think maybe got into it because they thought it would be cool to be on TV, and they're not really all that into it. And, you know, I've met many people who are just the opposite of that, who just love this stuff. And I think that's really huge. And I think also we want to think in terms of having empathy, because we are seeing more and more extreme weather. You know, things are changing very rapidly. And so, you know, it's going to be more and more important to inject a real good sense of a real sense of empathy into our reporting and what we do, because, you know, we are going to be dealing with a lot of cases where, you know, things are different. They're just not what they used to be. So, you know, I think being empathetic is going to be an important component of weather communication going forward.
Carl, let's close with that. And you mentioned this at the Gulf of Mexico conference. You mentioned the drought in Central America and how this was in part related with the El Nino, but you mentioned complete crop failure and that some of these people migrating on foot with their families through Central America up to the U.S. border are often in a state of desperation. And you mentioned this need for empathy and how it relates to these climate catastrophes. I mean, could you just close with kind of sharing, kind of continuing what you just started sharing about empathy and why it's so important?
Yeah, you know, we're going to see a lot of change in coming years. And, you know, I think, you know, unfortunately, there are elements of society who are very, very resistant to change, whether for good or for bad. And, you know, we're going to have to accept that things are going to be, you know, very different as compared to what they used to be. I mean, in the case of migration, you know, you have a corridor in Central America called the Central American Dry Corridor. And it's, you know, it's already dry, but their rainy season is from May to October. And in 2015, 2016, when they had a terrible spell there with El Nino, they got almost no rain during those rainy seasons. So there was huge crop failures, as much as 80% in some areas. And in rural areas of these nations, you know, El Salvador and Costa Rica and Nicaragua and Honduras, in rural areas, as much as half of people are subsistence farmers. In other words, they're growing what they're eating. And so their farms dried up, and some of them tried to move to the cities, but some of these cities, like San Salvador, are among the most violent, crime-ridden cities in the world. And so, you know, what we saw getting more towards, you know, 2019 was a huge rise in immigration, but not among single males the way it had been for a long, long time. It was, the biggest rise was in family units. So, you know, if we just stop for a minute and think about, you know, what it would take, you know, imagine, you know, you get your, you know, family and your kids, and you go on this, you know, 1,000+, maybe 2,000-mile journey to an uncertain future. You know, what would it take for you to have to do that? How bad would it have to be for you to have to do that? And, you know, that is a big part of what's happening here. And as it gets hotter and as it gets drier, these tropical regions are going to dry up even more. And there's going to be even more of a push factor. And we're going to have even more pressure on our southern border. So, you know, what we need to do is develop a humane framework for figuring out how to deal with this problem, because it's not going away. You know, we can't just, you know, ignore it. It's just going to be something that continues to get worse and worse and worse. And this is where, you know, empathy is really, really important. I think, you know, being empathetic is going to be a critical part of dealing with climate change. You know, it's really a human problem at the end of the day. And I think we've all got to, you know, think very differently about our neighbors and, you know, how we look at the world, because, you know, so many of these things that are already very challenging and very difficult are just going to be getting worse in the future.
Carl, I really appreciate you sharing the context of that. I think any of us could picture if our livelihood was subsistence farming and the rain shut off and the crops failed, at some point, right, out of desperation, we would do whatever it took to provide for our families, right? And I appreciate you sharing that context. I think it can help our listeners understand the issues better, but like you said, have more empathy with people that are doing what it takes, even if it's immigrating across international borders just out of desperation.
No question. I mean, you know, I just think we're going to be in for a really challenging time in the future. And I think we're going to really need to take a long, hard look at ourselves and how we react to these challenges.
Yeah, Carl, just appreciate, we covered a lot on this podcast, from your early days of meteorology to tropical weather to a glimpse at climate change and its impacts on the tropics. And then I'm glad that we ended by talking about communication, love for weather, and empathy. I think we covered it all in this podcast. And Carl, we're going to be really excited to continue watching your coverage on air. And I know the models are pointing towards perhaps a busy tropical season coming forward. So I think we'll be really curious to what you have to say as we go into this next act of tropical season.
Yeah, well, you know, the SSTs are boiling right now. I mean, they're comparable to what we see in June in the MDR. So hopefully that's not a sign of things ahead.
Yeah, it looks like it's at record level. Like you said, the tropical Atlantic is very warm. And it's like we said, the indications are that this should be a very active season, just with all that warm fuel and that water out there. Well, Carl, appreciate you taking time to come on the podcast. We're excited to follow you in your journey. And just thank you so much for coming on the podcast to share your insights with our listeners.
Thank you so much for having me, Hal. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Carl, for taking time to come on the podcast. I really loved our dynamic conversation in this episode. As we wrap up, three major points stood out to me from our discussion. Number one, we talked a lot about tropical weather and covered it from many different angles. I love that Carl recounted the surprising intensity of hurricane force winds, reminding us that there's no such thing as a quote unquote only Cat 1 hurricane. A Category 1 may sound weak on a scale of 1 to 5, but Carl's personal descriptions of Hurricane George and Brett remind us that every hurricane has the power to cause widespread destruction. We also talked about trends we're observing with rapidly intensifying hurricanes, as well as hurricanes moving forward with slower forward motion. Increasingly warm sea surface temperatures provide more fuel for hurricanes, and the trend in rapid intensification means coastal communities have less lead time to prepare and evacuate before a hurricane makes landfall. Slower moving storms prolong the wind damage, lead to more tree falls, and can greatly increase rainfall flooding. Number two, I love that Carl mentioned the importance of loving the science behind meteorology. If you love this science like many of us do, you're going to love your job and your passion is going to shine through. Carl mentioned that many of his colleagues share this love, but along the way, he's also come across a few people that got into broadcast meteorology, maybe for the wrong reasons, like thinking it would be cool to be on camera. You know, I found the same thing in my work with long-term climate risk analysis. Along the way, I've come across a lot of people who are passionate about weather and climate, which helped them get through long years as grad students with little pay, for example. But that said, I've also come across several individuals who do not really seem to have a deep love for weather and climate. They ended up in this sector based on political ideologies or because they thought they could find more funding in projects related to climate change. I have to agree with Carl on this. Do what you're passionate about, and the funding/job security is going to work itself out in your life. Finally, I really love Carl's perspective on having empathy for storm victims. This is so important as we forecast the impacts of extreme weather events. Keep in mind that the most intense storms can impact millions of people and change their lives forever. So while many of us get excited about the most intense displays of Mother Nature's power, on the ground, such storms can translate into the loss of someone's home, or in the worst case, loss of life. Carl mentioned that as extreme weather impacts continue to increase, we will need professionals who have a lot of empathy for storm victims. What great advice from a seasoned meteorologist who has forecasted so many destructive storms through the years. Carl, thank you so much for sharing your wisdom with us on this episode. We're excited to continue following your career and look forward to learning a lot more about the world around us when we see you on the air. Thanks everyone for tuning into this episode and for making the GeoTrek podcast the number one podcast on the topic of natural disasters, according to FeedSpot. Until we meet again, try to get outside and look up as much as you can during this beautiful spring season, and we'll catch you on the next episode of the GeoTrek podcast.